Jobcast, November 2025 edition, with Phoebe Ryder, Sahini Dutta, Leah Hawkswell, Louisa Mason, Jesse Marin, and Lily Correa Magnus. Hello, and welcome to the Jobcast. I'm Phoebe, and joining me in the studio today are Sahini and Thea.
In this month's episode, we've got lots of exciting news. This year, the UK Space Conference was held in Manchester, and so we had the opportunity to interview the CEO of the UK Space Agency, Paul Bates, and ESA astronaut, Rosemary Coogan. In our JodBite, we hear more about the Simons Observatory from Bernie Reid-Wichalla. But first, the news.
Neptune and Uranus might not be ice giants after all. Previous models of the interior of Uranus and Neptune have suggested that their cores are made of mixtures of water, ammonia, and other compounds that freeze easily in space, ice. However, a recent paper by Luca Morf and Ravit Helid have removed some of the preformed ideas we had on the planets and modelled them in an agnostic way. Their results challenge the idea that the planets are ice giants and highlight the need for more observations of the planets. Despite being in our solar system, we have limited data on Neptune and Uranus, as unlike other planets closer to us, they've not had any dedicated missions and were last investigated over 30 years ago by Voyager 2. The information we do have is indirect, like their magnetic fields, observations of surface atmosphere features, and subtle changes in the orbits of their moons, and these observations mean that there's a considerable variation in the planet's physical parameters, such as the ice-to-rock ratio. And by considering a wider range of starting possibilities, the models for the planet's cores could suggest that their cores are even rockier than that of Saturn and Jupiter. In order to get a definitive answer, though, we need a mission to visit our outermost planets in our solar system.
Citizen scientists just discovered the most powerful odd radio circle twins. This month, citizen scientists helped make one of the most exciting radio astronomy discoveries of the year. ORCs are gigantic ring-shaped structures seen in radio wavelengths, often stretching over a million light-years across. ORCs were first identified only 6 years ago, in 2019, by Anna Kapinska of the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, while perusing observations made by the Australian Square Kilometre Array Pathfinder, also known as ASCAP. ORCs are huge, up to 50 times larger than our Milky Way galaxy, which itself is about 100,000 light-years across. They are invisible at optical, infrared, and X-ray wavelengths. They are ghostly structures detectable only by radio telescopes. The radio rings were then confirmed by LOFAR, the low-frequency array of radio antennas across Western Europe and centered in the Netherlands. Discoveries like this show how new technologies and open data can blur the lines between professional and amateur astronomy. And as ORCs continue to puzzle scientists, this one might offer crucial clues about the violent life cycles of galaxies and black holes billions of years ago.
So, you might know of Europa as one of Jupiter's moons that might be able to harbour life in its oceans under its ice surface. But did you know that it might actually also glow in the dark? So a group of scientists have, in the lab, bombarded ice with different salts in with radiation. What they've observed is that this ice then gives off a small amount of visible wavelength radiation. So this isn't enough radiation that we'd be able to see it from Earth with Earth-based instruments, but it is enough that maybe if when Europa Clipper visits Europa in 2030, it might be able to see this glow.
Next up, Phoebe and Louisa chat to Paul Bate, CEO of UK Space Agency, on what the UK space industry can look forward to and the challenges of sustainable space.
Thank you for joining us in the studio today. Quite interestingly, you're from Manchester. You did a particle physics degree, PhD here. And so I suppose the first question is, what attracted you to getting into space?
First, thank you very much for having me on. Yeah, so I did my undergraduate and my PhD out of Manchester. What first got me into space, which is a long, long time ago, long before I was a student, I just love Doctor Who. I wish there was a better answer, there was a sort of more cerebral answer, but I am pretty sure that was the first little book I ever read. I remember my mum leaving it on my bed to actually get me reading. And I remember being clustered around the TV, watching it and hiding from the Daleks, like lots of people did. But I genuinely loved it. So much, I do remember at an interview, it wasn't an interview for Manchester, but for another university, citing Doctor Who as my main reason for wanting to do physics. I'm really not sure it was such a great idea at an interview, but that's the truth of it. And then after doing all the sort of stuff as a student, I got sidetracked for like 20 years to do healthcare and other things like that, which was great fun, but I found my way back to space.
Could you give us some snapshots of what to look forward to in the near future in the space industry?
Wow, what a great question. So the first thing to say about space industry is it's just so broad. So everything from your ubiquitous connectivity from a satellite so that everybody, every device on Earth is connected to satellites, or so-called directed device, that's coming fast, all the way through to discovery science. And, you know, we've got a probe, the JUICE mission, on its way to Jupiter, left about 18 months ago, take about 7 years to get to Jupiter. We've got a rover going up to the surface of Mars, launching 2028. We've got the Apophis asteroid that's going to come within the geostationary satellite belt. It's not going to hit the Earth this time around. And on April 13th, 2029. So we really have this golden age of space. I mean, I do think it is this decade like no other. So if some people remember the Apollo decade, but I think we're at least as exciting in terms of going back to the moon, the discoveries, the kind of commercialization of space, and just the fact that go back to 1957, the only thing orbiting the planet is the moon, and then Sputnik launches, and then, you know, a few other things launch, and we get to a stage where we're launching maybe 10 or even 100 satellites every year, and that carries on really to the last 5-10 years or so, and suddenly we hit this inflection point where we've now got well over 10,000 operational satellites in space, but we'll have 60,000 by the end of this decade. That's just crazy. That genuinely exponential rise just powers the way we can do things on Earth.
So speaking of kind of powering the future, I suppose something to look forward to is the next generation of scientists and engineers that you'll need to do that with. So what does the Space Agency do to encourage people to work in STEM in the UK?
First of all, we give out quite a lot of money, which never hurts. About £680 million this year we'll be funding, and that's everything from discovery science and the researchers all the way through to that commercialisation and space safety and sustainability. We also have a quiet mission, just to champion space, and that is everything from a 10-year-old girl, Mansfield, who may not see her life course as STEM-related, but whose eyes might literally be opened by what we can do in astronomy or space science or more broadly in the space sector. And everything up to the grizzled old banker who's not sure whether they should put their funds money into a space company or some other part of deep tech. That championing space is just part and parcel of what we do. And so when we're thinking about how we do that professionally, we run so-called Space to Inspire. That's what it says on the can. It's there to help people get into and understand space. We do Space to Learn. So we teach teachers to teach space, because a lot of the time they don't have the expertise or they don't have the knowledge, but we help the teachers. And we do try to reach through to some disadvantaged groups so that we're helping people recognise that space is for them, even if traditionally they may have not seen that path. All the way through for skills for space. So we have something like a 30,000 person gap between the number of people we would like to see in the sector to do everything that we could be doing right now and the number of people who are actually there. We've got about 55,000 people who are working in space, but we have jobs for so many more, and the space agencies are trying to drive that.
Space sustainability is a hot topic at the moment as well. Increasing satellite populations, as you mentioned, so space debris is also going to rise exponentially. Where does the UK stand on getting involved in these issues?
Yeah, so we've got quite a proud bit of heritage here. So we don't just have one of the most sort of forward-leaning regulatory environments, but we do. Since 2018, we've had the sort of the Space Industry Act, which means that when you fly a satellite up from the UK, when you license it through the UK, you have to be very clear about how you're going to have its end-of-life managed. We're not in the business of throwing metal up and hoping it's okay. So we've got all that side of things, which is actually really important for setting the right behaviours in space. But we also fund research into things like atmospheric ablation, so understanding whether it is safe or not to the orbit satellite into the upper atmosphere. We're really concerned that we don't actually know as a humanity how much metal, how much cross-section of satellites is sustainable. We all know that we have to have good rules of the road, but we don't know exactly how much. We're looking to parameterize that, so we're doing more research on that. In the lunar environment and beyond, we're part of the Artemis Accords, we're part of the international community, trying to get ahead of some very real challenges. I mean, the moon is big, right? But everyone is heading for the South Pole. That's where the water is. The very last thing we want to see is a kind of conflict in the sort of research sense, or conflict in a much more sort of defence sense, because we haven't agreed what the norms of behaviour on the moon are. So we're working carefully on that. And we work so closely with the UN, and we fund their sustainability guidelines, so that it isn't just perhaps the more seasoned space actors that can make sure that things are sustainable. But as more and more countries come on board, perhaps with less heritage or less time to work things out for themselves, those guidelines can be there to support everyone. And of course, space is for everyone. There's kind of a cosmic border for everybody. So it's not fair or appropriate that one country would simply choose to take all of it. So we're trying to kind of create a level of equity as well.
I think nowadays it's definitely an issue of like how many players are up in space and how many people are involved in launches and things like that. So as astronomers, we're very worried about the sky and especially contamination, both in the optical and the radio from passing satellites. So where does the UK Space Agency stand with this?
So we're trying to hit the balance, because you're absolutely right. It's deeply, deeply challenging in optical and, as you say, in radio too. And so we want people to act in the right way when they are launching satellites. But we also recognise the value of the satellites, and we have a job to do to support the in-orbit economy. So what we're trying to find a way, which isn't just to sort of find ourselves somewhere in the middle, but to actually work out what the right answers are and take them to the fora that will make a difference. So with the World Radio Conference, or a Congress coming up in 2027, we know there's a big block on dark and quiet sky, particularly on the quiet skies. It's not the sort of thing where you can sort of be on a platform and say, oh, it's big, it's a good thing or it's a bad thing. It really is quite a technical area. And as I said, we're trying to balance the UK's interests, and those are deeply scientific as well as deeply commercial.
Beyond sort of the next 10 years, where do you see the space industry going? What do you think the UK is going to really sort of be at the forefront of in the space industry?
I think one of the best questions, one of the sort of fascinating parts of being in such a fast-moving sector, is just how badly wrong you can get it by sort of trying to look into a crystal ball. I think we will see some very serious breakthroughs scientifically over the next 10, 20, 30 years. So we've only had James Webb Space Telescope up, 4 years this December? So that is doing absolutely groundbreaking work. We're learning more about the early universe and, of course, next planets as well. So we have this incredible array of space-based as well as terrestrial telescopes literally exploring the frontier of science here at the universe. I think we will find out more and more. Now, it's totally fool's errand to guess what's going to happen. One of the things, though, that I particularly excited on purely on the sort of astronomy side is the Habitable Worlds Observatory, the sort of next mega mission from NASA. And the intent of the UK is to play a leading role, just like we did in developing the mid-infrared instrument for JWST. We're now inviting applications, proposals to do a full instrument build for Habitable Worlds. And of course, nobody knows what Habitable Worlds will find, but one of the things I find most exciting about it is that the expected precision of the instruments means that if there is a signal of life on other planets in the galaxy, then it looks pretty likely we would find it. And equally, if there is no signal, we should be able to rule it out relatively well. Now, we know enough to know these are within uncertainties and error bars, but to be much more precise and much more confident one way or the other, I think that is humanity defining. That's before we've gone anywhere near direct-to-device or the next generation of navigation satellites, the whole in-orbit economy, so that we're no longer putting up a satellite and then letting it deorbit, now like driving your car once around the M25 in London and then leaving it on the hard shoulder. It's not a bright idea. The idea of sustainable space is going to become a reality for us. The things that we'll be able to do in tracking the climate crisis. The truth is we already use Earth observation satellites to power over half of the kind of essential climate variables. However, when we then look at the modelling and what the UNFCCC actually uses for its stock take of how much carbon dioxide there is and how we're doing on the climate emergency, space data isn't used as much as it should be. I think we will rapidly see that change. So across science, exploration, Earth observation, position, navigation, timing, across launch, across communications, I think we're going to see these changes, these leaps forward. We haven't even talked about building, manufacturing, assembling in space, or creating novel semiconductor materials or novel biologics that can change the face of pharmaceuticals and semiconductors on Earth. It's a good time to be in space.
Certainly exciting. I suppose the phrase, the sky's the limit, doesn't really kind of, I don't know, does it apply to the space agency? And I suppose you touch on the fact that even though we're looking beyond our Earth, you've got to build the instrument somewhere. So there is very much a terrestrial and a humanities element to building these instruments to then probe the universe.
Oh, there really is. So it's one of the things that people ask is, if taxpayer funded, I say, yep. And they say, and money is pretty tight, right? I say, yep. And they say, why on earth would we want to spend all that money in space? And then I say, well, it's not, is it? The thing might be in space, but it's all built in Manchester or in Stevenage or in Portsmouth or in Harwell or wherever it might be being developed and designed and manufactured. So we have this burgeoning space sector, 55,000 people working in the space sector in the UK. That's a sort of £17-18 billion sector annually. We've got 1,900 space organisations. That just defies belief. Not that I'm competitive, I'm a little bit competitive. One of the things we look at, how much does the UK invest in space, particularly on the civil side of space, which is what the UK Space Agency does? And then we compare that to how much of the space market globally. But we don't do it ourselves. We go to the OECD to do these comparative tables. And what that shows is that the US is the runaway leader in funding space, civil and military, but on the civil side. But they still actually, their share of the market is greater than the percentage of funding they put in. They do really well on that metric. And European countries typically don't do so well. Their ratio is less than 1-to-1. They don't capture as much of the market as they do in terms of the amount of money they put in. Fair enough. The UK, though, it's a real outlier in Europe because we get out 5 times what we put in. We're responsible for about 1% of civil space funding globally, and we have 5% of the market. Now, I think those data are compiled by different countries. I'm not sure I want to validate it to the second significant figure. But the difference between 5-to-1 and 1-to-1, or less than 1-to-1, there's a signal there. Something's happening. We're doing something right. And the truth is, we have this extraordinary scientific base in the UK. And Judge Rankin, a part of that, a very deep part of that, that's heritage, alongside the commercial sector and the sort of stable regulatory environment and that funding from the city. All those sorts of things, it comes together. And it's like this little crucible that you can build something incredibly special. And that seems to be the way it's going.
Quite nice to know, in a very complicated world and a very complicated space, we're doing something right. So that's quite nice to hear. Well, thank you very much for your time and coming to speak to us. And no doubt very excited to see what the UK Space Agency continues to do into the future.
Really grateful for the time. Go Lovell.
We were lucky enough to catch ESA astronaut Rosemary Coogan and to chat to her about what it takes to fly to space, what's next for the UK space exploration, and going from astrophysicist to astronaut.
So, thank you very much for coming and speaking on our podcast today. Absolutely honoured to speak to someone who's going to go into space. So, I suppose my first question for you is about your astronaut training. What was the best part? Is there a worst part to the training? Just kind of what your highlights are from that.
Yeah, and thank you so much for having me. And yeah, so that the astronaut training, it is really, really broad. It's really mixed. The best and worst parts are always a hard question. I think worst has to be the wrong word for it. I suppose there are points of challenge, but all of the training is really, really enjoyable, even though some of it is definitely quite hard, particularly when it's quite different from my background. So I would say one of the more recent trainings I've done has been the underwater spacewalk training, and that's been in Houston at the Johnson Space Center. And I think that has been probably my favorite, but also the most challenging part of the training recently. It was a very busy time during basic training. One of the biggest challenges was kind of how much information we got at once. But since then, for example, the EVA training was, it's both kind of mentally and physically kind of very, very intense. You're in a spacesuit, a pressurized suit. It's physically very difficult to move. You're underwater for many, many hours at a time, simulating a real spacewalk. So that's physically quite tiring. And then there's the psychological side of needing to have every protocol right to make sure that you are double attached to station at all times, that your tools also, you're not going to accidentally unclip something and cause a hazard and lose these tools. So I think that was very, very special. It was completely unique being in these very, very large pools with the mock-up of the space station and learning how to do that. So definitely one of my favourite parts, but also definitely the hardest thing I've done. It really took, a lot of preparation over kind of many months, those kind of many different practice spacewalks that we did. And I'm really happy now to have successfully completed that and looking forward to keeping it up, yeah.
So you touched on the sort of physical challenges and the mental challenges. I just wanted to ask a bit more about sort of how do you mentally prepare? Sort of physically, I feel like we can understand what you'd sort of do to prepare, but how do you prepare mentally?
Well, one of the things that a term that was very new to me when we started this training is chair flying, which I'd never heard of before. But it's essentially, you know, you're in your chair, you're in your office, you're at home, but you essentially shut your eyes and you're flying. So you go through every single detail of a task that you might be about to perform, sitting in your chair, but imagining everything that you're going to be going through. And by kind of learning exactly where you imagine to put your hands, what kind of your body position is going to be for a spacewalk, for example, it makes it much more efficient. You're much less likely to make errors when you do the task itself. Of course, the flip side to that is, of course, if things are unexpected, then the chair flying is out of the window in lots of senses. But there is certainly, it's a lot of mental preparation, really imagining how you're going to carry out these tasks. Of course, you can't practice in space. You can't practice being on the ISS. You have to, do a lot of that sort of mental preparation.
So before becoming an astronaut, you've already had a brilliant career as an academic and in research. So you've studied AGM and high redshift galaxies using ALMA. So what skills do you think you've been able to bring from the astrophysics research into your astronaut life?
I think, and it applies, I think, coming out of certain studies or doing a PhD to lots of different industries, you know, that we talk about doing a PhD, not just necessarily if you're going to carry on in research, but, you know, if it gives a lot of kind of, I would say, well-rounded skills that I hope that I can continue on with this next role. And I think that just centres around things like problem solving more generally. I mean, the PhD was something I really, really enjoyed, but, you know, it's a big chunk of time. There's this kind of end goal. I'm sure you know now that, you know, going through it, there's perhaps ups and downs, moments where it's all looking okay and moments where you think, oh my goodness, how is this the end of 3 years or so gonna? So I think a lot of kind of resilience. Working with international teams is something I experienced for the first time during my PhD, and I absolutely loved it. It was kind of completely life-changing to me, actually, to spend a year living in France during my PhD. It was the first time that I had lived abroad and had this kind of international experience, of course, you know, in any part of research or working with different teams. But that was a really, really big part of it for me. So not only the kind of academic skills of problem solving, but also those kind of, just that kind of widening, I think, of what's out there, what interested me, where I might want to live and go explore. It was a really positive experience. And I think a lot of that now can be brought to this role.
So now that you're a certified ESA astronaut, do you have an idea of what kind of missions you're going to be on, or what's next?
What's next? So the training is very much still underway. You're right. We finished our basic training, so we have now kind of graduated. We are certified, eligible for flight. And in terms of what we're really training for right now is a mission, a long-term mission, 6 months or so to the International Space Station. So really gearing towards living for a long time in low Earth orbit and getting ready to perform all different kinds of science on the station in that environment. That's very much what we think of as our next step for the class who've just been selected. But of course, thinking about space and space exploration more generally, everything is really changing right now. You know, as we perhaps start to look towards the end of the space station, there's going to be more perhaps commercial low Earth orbit, different stations coming coming up into orbit that will presumably also do both science and commercial activities, thinking about obviously building a station around the moon, going to the moon itself for exploration and further afield. So although our training is gearing towards the ISS, as a big picture for what we want to kind of contribute towards when we're not specifically in space or on a mission, there's a lot to be getting involved with. It's a really exciting time.
I think you've already answered this question, but I suppose looking at the future in general for UK space exploration, like where do you see the future going? What would you like to see, I suppose, in space exploration in the future?
Yeah, I think what I would like to see is very much a continued presence in low Earth orbit. It's really exciting to be going to the moon and to be going back to the moon with all of our kind of our new technologies, our new goals for how to do that. But there's still a huge amount that we learned from the microgravity environment, and that means a low Earth orbit station orbiting. So I'm really looking forward to, I think it's quite unknown right now exactly what post-ISS will look like. There's a lot of people very interested in it, a lot of companies interested in putting their offers forward, and I'm really looking forward to seeing which ones succeed, what we, you know, as ESA and the UK and as a community are going to be doing in space in the next few years. But I'm really looking forward to seeing this change and being able to carry on in all of those different directions.
So thank you very much for speaking to us.
No, sure.
And we can't
you.
Wait to see you go up in space.
Oh, thank you. And all the best of luck with the rest of your PhDs.
In our JodBite this month, Jessie and Lily talk to early career researcher Bernie Reid-Wachala about her work on the SZ effect and how the Simons Observatory will be helpful in her research. They also discuss her work in outreach and her part in the ongoing work to keep our skies dark.
Hi, I'm Jessie.
And I'm Lily. And we're here today with Bernie Reid-Wachala from Stanford University. And she's going to talk a bit about what she does, the SZ effect, and why she's here at the University of Manchester.
Hey, thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for coming. First, what is the SZ effect?
So I call it AZ, I guess is the US version of how people call it. It's a really nice effect that you find when you combine two types of data from different kind of observatories. So for context, we know the universe is expanding, but if you go back into time, you can think that the universe, rather than expanding, was more compressed. And when you have things that are more compressed, you tend to have higher pressures, and with higher pressures, you can reach higher temperatures, like when you cook at home and you have this pressure. I forgot the name in English.
Pressure cooker?
Yeah, exactly. You get higher temperatures. And if you reach really high temperatures, at some point, you get things that shine. So at some point, the universe was so much pressured and so much hot that it shined and emitted a lot of light. And that's called the cosmic microwave background. It's the light that have been traveling since the first epochs of the universe. It was emitted when the universe was more or less 380,000 years old and had been traveling for millions of years, billions of years, actually. And as the universe expanded, this light has also stretched its wavelength, changed its frequency, and nowadays is in the microwave regime. So we received this light, which is really homogeneous, though it has some fluctuations that we can chat more about. But when it travels, given that it's traveling through our universe that is expanding, the frequency goes down, the energy goes down. But sometimes those photons will encounter electrons from galaxies. And depending on the environment of that galaxy, those electrons that are actually a huge number compared to, you know, dark matter, we know it's much more abundant, but compared to, for example, the normal matter that you find in stars, these electrons are actually highly abundant. And if they have, you know, high temperatures, because maybe your galaxy or your cluster of galaxies is the temperature is really high, you'll have this electrons moving really fast, and they could scatter or interact with these low energy photons. When that happens, then somehow these electrons could transfer this energy to these photons, and then when you observe them, you will see a different frequency. And if you see this in the map, you will see this as almost like a shadow in this really homogeneous light. And that shadow comes from this interaction that I was saying. That would be the Sunyaev-Saldovich effect, or also called the thermal Sunyaev-Salavich effect. So thermal is because these electrons are really warm in this environment, and Sunyaev and Salavich is because this effect was first predicted by these two Russian cosmologists or astronomers or physicists, whatever you want to call it. And it was first detected in the 80s, if I'm not wrong. But then there's another type of effect that is called the kinematic Sunyaev-Salavich effect. So rather than your electrons having high energies because the environment is warm, you can have this kind of energy because maybe your galaxy is moving fast with respect to the expansion of the universe because maybe it's feeling the gravitational pull of its neighbor. So in other words, if I have two galaxies and they're feeling the attraction of each other, when the CMB photons come, they will interact with the electrons that are going to have this bulk velocity. And when they also interact, they will either absorb or give energy depending on the velocity along the line of sight of the observer. So in other words, you will get positive and negative like fluctuations of this light. So if you see the CMB map, you will see more parts that are like higher temperature because of maybe the galaxy is moving towards us, and so it's boosting the energy of the light of the CMB. Or the other way around, it's lower negatives because your galaxy is moving away from you. And that's something I study. It's a much fainter effect because it's proportional to the velocity of these galaxies. I can talk about it more or less, what are the ranges we expect of these velocities, but it's much fainter than the other one, the thermal EZI. And the first detection was made in 2012 with the Atacama Cosmology Telescope and a big cluster sample. And nowadays we're detecting it with a smaller galaxies, which is really exciting because we have a lot of telescopes, and I'm really excited of being able to measure this with the Simons Observatory.
Cool. I have a question because I come from simulations and I have a vague understanding of the SZ effect.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I could tell, the KSZ effect, you have to stack images of clusters to be able to actually measure it. You can't just measure it off of like a single object.
There's only one object that I have been observed with this effect.
Okay.
But it's like, because this effect, it's really, if you want to measure it, you have to have two conditions. Because the effect is proportional to how massive is your object or how many electrons it has. The more electrons you have, the more interaction you will have, and it will be easier to find it in your map, CMB map, or the cosmic macro background map, or if the velocity is high, because it's also proportional to the velocity.
Okay. So
if you have a really massive, for example, cluster that is about to, you know, collision with another big one, and their velocities are like thousands of kilometers per second, you might be able to see that in your CMB. And there's one paper that people, like, there's a whole research field that people do individual objects. It's really hard. But as you said, if you want to go to smaller objects, you have to stack, for example. You have to look for the galaxies in the sky and then go to your CMB map, go to those locations and then stack or, you know, sum them such that you can isolate the signal from the KSZE or the kinematic Sunyaev-Salavich effect.
And so you mentioned it was a very faint effect. And so I guess my first question is, when you boost it, like when the light is boosted, by how much does the wavelength change?
So it's a small effect. So for context, the CMB is the average temperature of that cosmic background light is 2.7 Kelvin. So it's like minus 270 Celsius, more or less. It's a really low temperature. But if you start to see the fluctuations of that light, the primary fluctuations, like the big ones you see from the early universe, actually, those corresponds to a few hundred microkelvin. So it's 10 to the minus 5 kind of Kelvin differences. So it's really small differences. But then on top of that, you have this even tinier, more tiny fluctuations. They're even smaller scales, spatial scales, because they're the size of a galaxy, those correspond to a few microkelvin on top of a you know, light that is already fluctuating over 100 microkelvin. So you have to, you know, get that signal is hard, right? It's just like a tiny variation on top of like an ocean of information that is variating. So unless you have a really massive object that is moving at really high velocities, but these velocities are not transversal. These are like along the line of sight. Otherwise, you would not be able to see this effect. You can measure this. The challenge is to also measure the velocities, and that's a whole different story. How do you measure velocities of a lot of galaxies? It's not trivial.
And sort of taking a step back, just to give a bit of context, why is the ESED interesting to cosmologists? Like, what can you do with this? What can you do with measuring this change in intensity in clusters and galaxies?
So there are many things you can do by measuring this KZ. So let's think about first that you're tracing the electrons, and therefore you're tracing, we say, the gas. You're not tracing stars, you're not tracing dark matter from galaxies, you're tracing those particles that otherwise are really hard to observe. There are only a few ways you can do it, and all of them have their own challenges, but when you learn about that gas, you can learn about the history of that galaxy, and if you do it with many galaxies, you can learn how spread that gas is. It's not the same to find it, like, let's say I have a galaxy, and then, like, you move, whatever, 5 times the size of the galaxy to the side, and you find gas, or 10, or 20, right? That means there's something, an astrophysical effect, that is pushing gas to the outskirts of the galaxy, or further, to the outskirts of the dark matter halo, which is a whole different story that I'm happy to chat about. But in a summary, if I'm able to tell people how extended that gas is, farther away from that galaxy, they can learn about what are the astrophysical phenomena that are pushing gas outside. In other words, active galactic nuclei, big black holes that are accreting material and pushing it to the outskirts, and that's, you know, not easy to observe otherwise. And if you go to probably, you know, if you talk with people that work on simulations, one of the challenges is to, where should I put the gas? So this is a way of telling people that do simulations how much is, you know, they should push the gas outside. That's one use case of this effect. Other one is that when you do studies of, you know, the model of the universe, this gas is actually a lot of the matter component of the universe. So you probably have chatted already about this classic pie chart of like, how much dark energy you have in the universe, how much dark matter and how much regular matter. And everyone is super surprised that that regular matter is, you know, much a smaller percentage. But in that small fraction of matter, only 10% is in the stars. So you're missing the other 90% of regular matter, which is actually in the form of gas. So if this gas is extended a lot, that means it can, you know, impact the whole distribution of the matter around that galaxy, including dark matter. So people that are studying to determine those values of those parameters of dark matter, dark energy, etc., if that gas is changing the distribution of all the other matter in the universe, when you do your analysis with data, you're going to be biased. So right now it's a huge systematic, we say, of people doing cosmological analysis with galaxies. So if, you know, there's a whole, I don't know if you have chatted in other episodes about weak lensing or gravitational lensing.
Yeah.
The thing is that right now when people do weak lensing of galaxies, they throw a lot of data because they don't know how to model the scales that where the gas is. And this is telling them somehow with data how the gas should be distributed and therefore how can they reach those scales. I hope that was not that technical, but in other words, I'm helping them to do their analysis because we can't ignore this amount of, you know, gas in the universe because it's, you know, as I said, 90% of the regular matter. And a final use that you can have for this, as I said, is the KZ is proportional to the number density of electrons, or how many electrons you have. And then the other side is also proportional to the velocity. So if you instead, let's say you don't care about the gas, but you care about the velocities, well, it's not the same to have a universe with, you know, 1,000 kilometers per second galaxies moving crazy, rather than like a steady universe. And that tells you about also the history of the universe. And if you can study this through different epochs of the universe, how much this velocity has changed, you can predict how the universe started, how is it evolving, and if you need more, maybe dark matter at the beginning to be able to, you know, maybe get this gravitational pull to move stuff. So, or the initial conditions might be different. So it is also used for that particular case. I'm mainly studying the case of studying the gas through the KSZ, but there's colleagues that are actually attending this Simons meeting we're having here in Manchester that are working on the velocity side.
Cool, thank you. I think that's a good segue to move on to the SO meeting that's happening and sort of the reason that you're here.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of to give, I think we've done an interview with someone who worked on the instrumental part of it, and it'd be cool to hear from like the science side, like what you're going to do with SO and how it's going to help your research and why it's so important.
Yeah, so probably I've introduced the Simons Observatory located in Chile, the best country of all of them. I'm by a bit biased because I'm Chilean. But yeah, the Simons Observatory is located in the north of Chile, in one of the best places where you can ever have a microwave telescope because of the dry conditions, as you probably discussed already with the previous invited speaker. I'm really excited because right now is a really great moment to not only use Simons because of the conditions and the great data you can get, is the fact that it's also happening at the same time you have other telescopes starting, and I'm interested in combining them. Like for the KSZ, for example, effect, I need to know where galaxies are. I cannot just go to the CMB telescope and try to localize them. You need to combine it. And we have reached such a high resolution. So if people are listening to us, I think a really nice experiment you can do is to go and search the history of the CMB telescopes that have been. So you start with GOVE, which is like, you know, this like big spots that you can see in the sky. Then you go to WMAP, like resolution goes high. Then you go to Planck, and it's like putting like glasses and you start to see even more details. But when you go to Simons Observatory, we're seeing like really, 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 really tiny details. And we're like able to see galaxies in my CMB map, which is crazy to think about it. Like if you mentioned this to the Wilson and Penzias back in the 60s, that we were gonna be able to have that such resolution, they'll be like, this is insane, right? Those Wilson and Penzias were the ones that discovered the CMB, by the way, but back in the 60s. The thing is that for me, the most exciting thing is gonna be able to try to see the sky with this new like window. It's like putting glasses and seeing a complete different view of the universe, and it's really exciting, and it's enabling things like the KSZ, but there are many other science cases, and it's just crazy we can use it to understand the early origin of the universe, but also, you know, our neighboring galaxy or neighboring galaxies, or you know, the whole cosmic story. Because, you know, it's like backlight that have been traveling for billions of years, 13 billion years, to reach us.
That's really cool. It makes it sound more exciting. I always hear the technical part, like, oh, this is a great telescope, it's massive. And I'm like, oh, actually, the science is pretty cool as well.
Yeah. I mean,
sorry.
the talks have been really, really exciting. And I am actually, as I said, it's not only this telescope, it's the fact that you can combine it with other state-of-the-art telescopes that are either in Chile too, or they are pointing the same area of the sky. So let me just mention two. One is the Dark Energy Spectroscopic Instrument located at Arizona in Kitt Peak, which is a huge spectrograph that have been taking spectra from galaxies, and in one shot it can take 5,000 spectra.
in 1 year, it took more data than the previous telescope that took 20 years. So the amount of data we're getting is just insane. And, you know, my results are, you know, my advisor was showing me his, you know, his papers when he was a student. And, you know, he would have a really tiny signal. And people, when we would see his plots, will be like, I don't know if you're detecting something. But now I'm showing it with this data. And everyone is like, wow. And it's just exciting. And another telescope that you probably have mentioned, or if not, you're probably going to talk about it, is the Vera C. Rubin Observatory, located in Chile, not in the same site as Simon's, because if you have an optical telescope, you don't need the same, you know, you don't have to have the same dry conditions, and, you know, it can be in different locations. So that one is in the La Serena, more or less, part, which is a bit more in the south. And, you know, the camera just started taking pictures.
I've seen some pictures. It's beautiful.
It's just insane. Yeah. It's just insane the amount of data we're going to have, or we are having already. And this projects take decades, and it's just amazing to see that they're all happening at the same time.
No doubt, a few thousand graduate students gonna be working away at
analyzing the data.
Analyzing all data, yes.
They were born at the right time.
And so, beyond your work in science, we know that you're quite involved with outreach and talking to people about astronomy. And so, I was wondering if you could maybe talk a little about that.
Yeah. So actually, this is my first ever podcast in English. I usually do outreach in Spanish because I'm from Chile. I was raised in Santiago, and I lived there until I was more or less 25 years old. So before I moved to the US to do my PhD, I was raised in Santiago, as I said, but I spent a lot of my childhood in the north of Chile. So I got exposed to astronomy really early in my life. Just by, you know, going out with my cousins trying to find shooting stars in the desert. And I think that's a unique experience because I think I have a really strong connection with astronomy, with my identity and my life. That doesn't mean my whole life I wanted to be an astronomer, though. It was more when I was a kid, and then in the university I realized I liked a lot of physics and I wanted to do astronomy. And yeah, outreach. When I was in my university, I was studying really hard, and then the pandemic happened, and my department back in Chile, I studied in the University of Chile, had a really strong, like, they have a strong outreach team, and they asked me if I wanted to participate, because someone said I talk a lot, by the way, and I was like, oh, sure. And they were like, yeah, you can get some money. And I was like, oh, I'm a student and I couldn't work because I was at the same time studying and working. And during the pandemic, I couldn't give the math lessons I used to survive. So I was like, of course I can do, you know, classes and get paid a bit. I mean. And that's when I started doing outreach in Chile. I would go to, you know, TV shows. And at that time, there were many nice events happening. There was Perseverance landing in Mars. Then we have James Webb opening the eyes. So, and then also Chileans had like almost 2.5, and I can explain why, solar eclipses happening like one after the other one. The 0.5, it was in the Antarctic, so at least, you know, the penguins could see it, but Chile has some territory in the Antarctic. But at least two solar eclipses that I think changed a lot the mindset of people, how, you know, the approach to outreach. There's also a lot of like big professors that have done a lot of outreach, and when you have more senior people doing it, it's more appreciated, I think, in the community, in the astro community, because then, you know, it's like seen as a good thing rather than like something that more young folks do. But yeah, then I started to do it. I have an Instagram account that I use sometimes. Nowadays I'm doing my PhD, so I'm pretty busy. But I always take my time to do this because I think it's really important. And it's so beautiful. I mean, it's just observing the sky, understanding it. It's just so pure. And like, I think when you do outreach, you can talk with anyone, even though you might have a lot of differences. Those differences just vanish. And I really like that, being able to
you know, reach to people that I might never otherwise in my life.
That was really well put.
And so one thing that I think is very important as well in outreach, and which I know you are also involved, is keeping our skies dark. And so I was just wondering if you could kind of give us a very quick rundown of why it's so important and how we can help it, like help keep the stars visible.
Yeah, so dark skies is an important topic in Chile because we have so many telescopes. Actually, more than 50% of the ground-based telescopes in the world are located in the north of Chile. So it's a huge thing. And a lot of people receive a lot of benefits from it, either from astrotourism, the science that is developed, the instrumentation that, you know, engineers get involved. So we receive a lot of benefits and people really like it. Actually, I recently saw this poll that they asked Chileans what are they most excited about, or proud, sorry, I should say. What are they most proud about in their country? And first one was nature, and then it was astronomy and like the skies of Chile. So Chileans had a good appreciation of it. And we have a law right now that aims to protect dark skies. However, it has some flaws, and right now there's a whole discussion in Chile on how to improve it. It's really important because, you know, we're not only using telescopes to observe the sky, as you probably have realized, and with your other invited speakers, astronomers are always thinking of what's coming next. And when you think of what is coming next, you study the territory, you go to where you want to put the telescope, you do a study case of what is the light pollution you might have, and you start constructing it. It takes decades to construct a telescope and you have the first light. But then in those 20 years or 15 years that you're planning and constructing, you could have that the light pollution conditions change, and, you know, that can ruin your telescope, especially if you're, you know, aiming to those conditions to be kept. So right now, there's a whole discussion on how to maintain that. At the same time, some companies want to build, you know, projects that include mines or hydrogen extraction and so on and so forth. And the question is, how do you indeed allow development for green sources, green energy, and so on and so forth without impacting astronomy? There's a whole discussion happening right now, but I'm really glad that a lot of people there value astronomy and they'd want to keep that happening. I think it's a battle we will always have in our life to keep dark skies. I'm not going to talk about all the benefits of having dark skies and illuminating correctly. That's the other thing. One thing is to have, like, you know, dark skies. Another thing is to illuminate, you know, cities and towns correctly, just not pointing light into the sky that you're just going to miss anyways. And also teach people how to illuminate. Like, I was having this conversation with someone telling me, oh, but can you just put, like, a fence or whatever? And I'm like, no. The reason why light pollution is so horrible is because, same as the KSZ or the SZ effect, is that when you have light, that light could interact with the particles in the atmosphere, and then they get scattered. So even though you're illuminating one side, the light will propagate in all directions anyways. So it's not just like pointing to other sides or to another direction. It's doing it correctly. So I think you'll probably see more news of this in the future. And yeah, I guess you can invite someone who's more expert on this because I'm doing more research. But there's a lot of interesting people aiming to protect the dark skies in Chile.
Cool. Thank you.
Yeah. So, Bernie, thank you so much for coming and for taking the time to talk with us today. We hope that the rest of the meeting goes well, and good luck with the rest of your research.
Yeah, thank you. Same for you.
From Facebook, James Walters writes, "Great episode. Loved hearing about the Simons Observatory." And remember, if you want to get in touch, you can do so via Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Blue Sky, or send us post. Links and details can be found on our website at www.jodcast.net.
Thank you to Paul Bate, Rosemary Coogan, and Bernie Reid-Wachala for the interviews.
The audio editors were Tobias Russell, Thea Huxwell, Josh Bishop. The show editor was Alex Walls and Louisa Mason. The producer was Lily Correa Magnus and Jesse Marin.
Until next time,
Jot on!